loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, The Intercept reported today that former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was fired thanks to pressure from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Tillerson had intervened to mediate those countries' dispute with neighboring Qatar. Saudi Arabia had intended to invade and conquer Qatar with UAE help. Next, the Trump administration this morning announced that it was freezing fuel efficiency requirements for all cars and trucks through 2026 as part of a dramatic rollback of Obama-era environmental regulations. The announcement comes on the heels of a weakening of air and water quality regulations. Then, Israel has blocked the delivery of fuel and gasoline to the besieged Gaza Strip, saying that it was in retaliation for Palestinians setting fire to Israeli land with flaming kites. Only cooking gas, wheat, and flour will be allowed into Gaza until further notice. And then Pope Francis announced this morning that the death penalty is inadmissible under any circumstances and that the Church will work toward its abolition around the world. The announcement marks an evolution of the Catholic Church's official view of the death penalty that began under Pope John Paul II in 1978. And finally, the Trump administration has imposed sanctions on the justice and interior ministers of Turkey in retaliation for the continued incarceration of American pastor Andrew Brunson. Brunson was arrested 2 years ago and charged with espionage for preaching. He has yet to go to trial. Turkish President Erdogan said the move will jeopardize longstanding U.S.-Turkish relations and that Ankara will consider retaliatory sanctions. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Saudi Arabia. The Intercept reported today that former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was fired thanks to pressure from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Tillerson had intervened to mediate those countries' dispute with neighboring Qatar. Saudi Arabia had intended to invade and conquer Qatar with UAE help. We're joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, welcome back to the show. It's been a long time.
Yes, thank you very much.
Ali, I want to read a little bit to you from the Intercept article and then have you comment. And John, of course, because you have been there as well, this is an area that's not only important to people in the region and, of course, to the countries there. It's also important to the United States because it's a hub of the U.S. military, in fact. So I want to read a little bit from the article. It said the attacks against Qatar's emir would have involved Saudi forces circumventing the Al Udeid Air Base, which is home of the U.S. Air Force Central Command and some 10,000 American troops, and seizing Doha. That air base serves as one of the U.S. most important overseas military bases and carries out operations throughout the Middle East. However, after Tillerson was notified by the plan by Qatari intelligence officials, he reportedly urged Saudi Arabia's King Salman not to carry out the attack and also encouraged Defense Secretary James Mattis to explain the dangers of such an invasion to his counterparts in the kingdom. Pressure from Tillerson caused Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, also known as MBS, to back down, who was concerned that the invasion would damage Saudi Arabia's long-term relationship with the United States. Help us just unpack that, Ali.
Well, look, any invasion, Saudi invasion or military operation of any scale in Qatar would not have been possible without a U.S. green light. One of the things that people should know, when there is an American base in any country, it has theater of operation. It has a geographical area of coverage. They defend that not only the base, but the zone where they cover. Meaning if Saudi forces came to Qatar without green lights from the U.S., they would have been shot at by the Americans because no prior arrangements were made. This happened in Bahrain, and this is something that people didn't write about, is the Saudi, whatever they call it, intervention, or I call it invasion, of Bahrain in 2011 was done with the pre-approval of then Secretary Gates. The defense secretary, and with the approval of President Obama, because you cannot move military forces near American base without prior approval. Otherwise, the base will go on high alert and even shoot you down. And this is exactly what was needed for Qatar. That green light was somewhat given and I think retracted, and that caused the invasion or the takeover of Doha to stop by the Emiratis and Saudis. And if they had that in the green light for a day or two, that it would have been done. I also was privy later on to information that the invasion, we talked about to circumvent Al-Udeid, the invasion was supposed to come from the northern side of Qatar. It's very easy for the Saudi Navy to come, or the Marines, the American trade Saudi Marines to come through this open area of northern Qatar, coming from Bahrain and from Al Jubail and Dammam bases, to come to Qatar and land in that open shore that gives them direct about half an hour drive to Doha, while avoiding the Al Udeid base, which is on the south side of the country and south of the capital, southwest of the capital. And that was the plan that was. I was able to get some information on. And we shared that information with the Qataris. I haven't seen any thanks or thank you notes from them for that. But nevertheless, it's important that I hope I was able to, in some way, to stop a war, stop people from dying, no matter who they are, either Saudi soldiers or Qatari civilians, or because we need less conflict in our region, not more.
Indeed. We're speaking with Ali Al-Ahmed from Washington. He's the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, you made a point a minute ago that I think is important, and I want to repeat it. The Saudis actually have a history of intervening in other Gulf states. You mentioned Bahrain in 2011. I was living in Bahrain in 1996 when the Saudis intervened. First with special forces called the U Group, dressed all in black. Their job was to shoot and kill Shia Muslim demonstrators. They ended up sending regular troops across the causeway, and they stayed there for almost a year. There have been border clashes with the Qataris in 1991 and 1996, where Saudi troops crossed the border in the desert and actually shot and killed Qatari troops and border guards. This notion of a naval invasion from the north of Qatar, I think, is probably an excellent idea if you're a military planner, because the Qataris would expect something across the southern border, not the north by sea. And I believe that you're also right that it was Rex Tillerson that said that there's not going to be a green light. And that's probably the only thing that saved this from becoming a full-fledged war. One other point, too, I want to ask you about was Al-Udeid. Al-Udeid is the United States' largest Air Force base in the entire region. And it's the only base with a runway long enough to accommodate a B-52 long-range bomber. What do the Saudis want, or the Emiratis? Do they want the United States to close this base and move it to the Emirates?
I don't think that was the goal. Absolutely not. I don't think the Saudis have a beef with an American base in Qatar, because they have given. Remember, Saudi Arabia was the first Arab country to host an American base back in the 30s.
Yes.
Not, before even World War II. And I remember my father was telling me, my father somehow, who never went to any university, speaks a little bit Italian, from the Italian war prisoners who were working as in the oil fields in Bahrain while he was selling goods to workers there. And he interacted with those Italian prisoners of war who were working by Americans, made them work in the oil field in Bahrain. And they were basically prisoners, but because they couldn't escape, so they were basically free in the area and interact with the locals. So the Saudis have hosted American troops for many, many years, even before the World Wars. And that is not something they are concerned about. They're concerned about who controls the Qatari wealth. Qatar has $45 trillion worth of gas and other oil products. And that is very, very lucrative and very tempting. They need the money to expand their empire, to maintain their kingdom. And Qatar seems to be the easiest way to do it. And that's why they wanted to share that with the Emiratis. That gas would have funded the economies of both countries for generations.
And that's so important what Ali is saying. Ali is making the point that what the Saudis and what the Saudi royal family wants is just Qatar's wealth. And here, remember, and again for our audience, which who may not remember because people have short-term memories and the news cycle is so fast, so repetitive, so relentless, it's hard to remember. But Donald Trump went to Saudi Arabia. His first visit abroad was to the Saudi royal family. And right afterwards, he joined in the chorus organized by MBS, the Crown Prince, and the Saudi royal family against Qatar and said, Qatar is a source of terrorism and we're going to shut it down. Then, of course, Tillerson and the others ameliorated that position. But Ali, what you're saying that behind it all is not terrorism or anti-terrorism. It's just about looting Qatar's wealth. 1 minute left.
Absolutely. I think we're talking about terrorism. Saudi Arabia is takes the cake. Trump did speak about it for a while, but then he kind of left it alone. And that happened before with other American presidents and administration. The goal here is to take Qatar's money. But the most important, I think, lesson from him that people talk about meddling. This is how Saudis and UAE are able to basically meddle with American foreign policy and remove Secretary of State from his position. That is a crime. That is something that Mueller, who I think is also guilty of doing the same thing for other cases that I'm familiar with, should investigate. And how can an absolute monarchy influence the decision that the U.S. elected president is making on foreign policy and even on staffing? And this is unfortunate. It's been going on for too long, and I hope the Trump administration puts an end to it.
Is it fair, Ali, to say that there was foreign meddling in the U.S. by the Saudis?
Absolutely. This is nothing new. And what is most concerning is people talk about Russian meddling, which is something they should do, but leaving the Saudi and Emirati and others even meddling in U.S. Elections and funding candidates and supporting the removal of secretaries of state or other officials from the U.S. government. This is even worse than what we talk about in terms of Russian meddling, because it did not pay officials to do something or not to do something.
Yeah, and that's something, John, that, it's really missed, and it is a big part of the story.
Nobody talks about it.
The outsized influence of the Saudis in American politics with American politicians, in this case, with Rex Tillerson's career as Secretary of State, really something.
Yeah, it's true. The American people really are not focused on the amount of money that the Saudis spend in U.S. politics. Millions and millions of dollars in lobbying. The Saudis are here all the time. It's a lot of money. Anyway, we'll leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration this morning announced that it was freezing fuel efficiency requirements for all cars and trucks through 2026 as part of a dramatic rollback of Obama-era environmental regulations. The announcement comes on the heels of a weakening of air and water quality regulations. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff, Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation, from Monthly Review Press. Fred, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Fred, there are costs and consequences to a decision like this. What exactly are we looking at here?
Well, one of the things they're trying to do, I don't know if they're going to be able to pull this off or not, is not only to deal with national standards, but to prohibit states like California from having their own standards, which are more, severe, if you will, than the federal ones, that are tougher, if you will. So that part of it is not clear that they can do that. But basically what it's going to mean is that, the air will be polluted more than it would have been otherwise. And with health effects for people who live in areas of concentrated automobile use and effects on the climate as well, because of the emissions that would have been controlled by the standards that will not be because of this change.
I'm looking at a piece in Vox that was published today. It says that the EPA is also revoking the Clean Air Act waiver that allows California to set its own air quality standards and thus its own fuel economy standards. That would force California and the 13 other states, plus the District of Columbia, that follow California's lead on fuel economy to conform to a federal standard that is certain to be weaker than they would like. And then there was a tweet by Javier Becerra, the former congressman who's now California's attorney general. He says the Trump administration has launched a brazen attack, no matter how it's cloaked, on our nation's clean car standards. California Department of Justice will use every legal tool at its disposal to defend today's national standards and reaffirm the facts and science behind them. Hashtag EPA, hashtag cleaner cars. So it looks like this is heading to the courts. But with that said, does this president not have the authority to just wave his magic wand and do this anyway because it's an executive decision?
That's not clear to me anyway. And apparently the California folks are going to try to fight it. It's not clear whether they're able to just undo something like that, a waiver that was given to California and other states. I think California really has been the leader in this area for years. This is not new. We'll have to wait and see what the courts have to say. It will certainly be challenged.
It's a war against clean water, a war against clean air. I mean, when you go through it, it's pretty staggering, Fred, that this administration has declared war on all these things that Americans consider to be vital. I mean, perhaps 40 or 50 years ago, people might have thought, well, these, you know, environmentalists are overdoing it, blah, blah, blah. But that's not the case now. The consciousness is people know their water was polluted and it got better as a consequence of regulations. Our air was more polluted. Smog was worse. It became easier to breathe as a consequence of regulations. I mean, how does he get away with it?
Well, how does he get away with all this stuff? I mean, it's he's basically a bully. He just makes decisions with very little thought in many cases of the consequences or concern about the consequences, he just throws them out there, and he's doing this with so many things. You know, it's hard to fight them all, at the same time. So, I think you're right. I think the American people do want clean air, and the American people do want clean water. I mean, who doesn't? You know, who wants to say, I'd rather breathe air that's more polluted. I'm not getting my dose of pollution in my lungs. I mean, that's absurd. And even the car companies are not, some of the manufacturers are not really, don't really like this all that much. They were planning on having these changes. They were planning on the parts that were needed for it, et cetera. So I think some of the companies are pretty happy with it, but there are within the manufacturers some concerns about it. And I think they're going to try to get some parts of it.
I think I know the answer to my own question. I've thought about it, John. I think the reason Trump is getting away with poisoning our water and our air is that we haven't figured out how poisoned water or poisoned was actually part of a Kremlin plot.
Ah, there it is.
Because
that
appears to be the entire focus of all public scrutiny of Trump's campaign is, again, the Facebook shutdown, 7 Facebook posts and 17 profile, and the Senate is meeting and the House is meeting, and you look at the headlines about the shadowy plot to disrupt our democracy. Here, this is not a shadowy plot. They're poisoning the water. They're poisoning the air. They're taking away any regulations that inhibit maximizing profit for corporate capitalists who are already super rich, most of them like Trump billionaires. And yet the Congress is focused on the threat posed by Russia, and too many liberals and too many people who historically have thought of themselves as progressive are sort of over-focused, have become spectators to Russiagate, while the real crimes of the Trump administration, poisoning air and water on behalf of corporations, it's not the focus. That's the reason.
And don't forget what's happening with the Affordable Care Act. You know, they were not able to to get Congress to derail it completely. But what they're doing is trying to derail it slowly but surely by different types of changes in the regulations. And so there are going to be a lot of people who are not going to be able to have coverage Or if they have coverage, they're going to have much poorer coverage. In other words, it's not going to cover as much. They'll have higher deductibles, et cetera. So, I mean, it's in all areas of social and environmental concerns that what they're doing is regressive, basically. It's horrible. And, hopefully, a majority of people will come to see it. And hopefully, even though with the gerrymandering that's occurred and with the vote suppression which has occurred and continues, hopefully they'll be able to vote in some people who will stand up to this.
We're speaking with Fred Magdoff. He's Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont. Fred, the Union of Concerned Scientists put out a blog post today that I think was just wonderful. It's called Eight Ridiculous Things in the Trump Rollback of Clean Car Standards. And they list them as absurdity number one through absurdity number eight. I'd like to know your thoughts on these. I'm just going to rattle them off quickly, and then you can pick whatever you want. Number one is consumers will benefit from the rollback. They won't benefit. Number two, more efficient vehicles will be less safe. They've already proven to be more safe. Number three, the fleet will get older and travel more without the rollback, and therefore they will be less safe. Absurdity number four, energy dominance means we don't have to worry about conserving energy. Number five, zero emission vehicle standards are inherently fuel economy standards. Number six, manufacturers will improve fuel economy without regulations on their own. I actually chuckled out loud when I read that one. Number seven, manufacturers will put on more technology than is necessary to meet the standards. And number eight, everyone's going to need to drive a turbo hybrid by 2025 if the standards aren't rolled back. What do you think of those?
Well, no, I think they're right. I mean, it's all nonsense, their claims. It's just like in other areas, they just say things. You know, they make statements. I'm talking about Trump and other members of the administration that have bear no relation to reality, and they just put it out there. And, I think the Washington Post has a list of, I've forgotten what it is, it's like 2,000 things that Trump has said since he came into office that were either not true or were sort of barely true. I mean, not, either partially not true or completely not true. And the incredible thing is that they say these things, they get away with them, and this group can contradict it, but somehow it's not being challenged. I think part of the problem is there's so many things coming at once, you know, on different issues. I mean, you know, there's these standards, the water issues, as I mentioned, the healthcare, what's happening with Iran, whatever it is, all these things are happening. The trade war, you know, that he started. That appears going to be his trade war, and he's tweeting, you know, multiple times a day, and it thinks so much, so many things are coming at people at once, that on different subjects, that it's hard actually to get traction on any response to anything, because 5 minutes later there's going to be something new in the news, so I mean that's part of my understanding of why. You know, he's able to, and the administration has been getting away with so much, is because they're doing so many different things in so many different areas that it's hard to even keep up with it.
You know, I think that that's something that they count on as a strategy, that there's so much happening all at the same time, from the Mueller investigation through EPA regulation rollbacks, that people are overwhelmed, and so they don't focus. I think that's actually a strategy. But we're out of time, unfortunately. We have to leave it there. We were joined from Burlington, Vermont, by Fred Magdoff. He's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont, and he's the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism, and also of Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation, which is published by Monthly Review Press. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Israel has blocked the delivery of fuel and gasoline to the besieged Gaza Strip, saying that it was in retaliation for Palestinians setting fire to Israeli land with flaming kites. Only cooking gas, wheat, and flour will be allowed into Gaza until further notice. We're joined from Washington by journalist and filmmaker Dan Cohen. Dan, welcome.
Good to be with you guys.
John, you know a lot of things about history. Collective punishment,
yes,
against a whole people.
Yes.
Didn't that come up at Nuremberg? One of the chief crimes?
Yeah, I seem to remember the term crimes against humanity or something like that.
Dan Cohn, collective punishment.
Well, without a doubt. I mean, Avigdor Lieberman, the Israeli defense minister, cited kite terrorism, which is a new term I've never actually heard of. And it's just so absurd. It would be hilarious if it didn't involve such a drastic form of collective punishment for millions of people. I mean, basically the situation in Gaza is you have 2 million people under siege, more than half of them are children. Before this closure of the Kerem Shalom crossing, the only commercial crossing into Gaza, there was 3 to 4 hours of electricity per day. And so what this closure does is it renders the Gaza Strip completely in the dark. So that means hospitals cannot operate. Basic medical supplies and operations cannot go on. People can't use the internet. They're completely cut off from the world. They don't have lights. The basic necessities of life have been taken away for 2 million people. And it's just a blatant act of collective punishment, as you guys said.
So what happens then? I mean, the Israelis do this every once in a while, and the measures are usually temporary, but this is going to take a toll on people. People, and I'm not overstating this, I don't think, but people are going to die because of this.
Oh, without a doubt. People have been dying, not only because of the lack of electricity, but just under siege. Israel prevents medical patients from traveling outside of Gaza in order to receive care that they desperately need. I mean, Lieberman said that this will go on until Palestinians stop sending kites, incendiary kites over the fence that separates them from Israel. But it's being used as a pretext to carry out this massive collective punishment. But the kites actually haven't injured anyone. The Israelis have said that it's caused millions of dollars in damage to agricultural fields. But that's, really, at worst, it's a tit-for-tat move by Palestinians, considering the Israeli military regularly drops herbicide and destroys Palestinian crops, not to mention 35% of the Gaza Strip along the what's called the buffer zone, the agricultural land along the fence that separates Israel from Gaza. That is all considered an open fire zone. So any farmer or anyone who walks out on that land can be shot. At worst, it's a tit for tat move, but no one has actually been injured by these incendiary kites. It's simply just a form of protest against, being under siege and displaced and, under constant occupation. And really, that's what this is about. And so until Israel can, get through its thick skull, basically, that these kinds of, whether it's kites or tunnels or whatever else, Palestinians will always find a way to protest being under occupation.
We should remember, too, that we're talking about 2 million people who are packed into the Gaza Strip. And at the same time, just, 2 or 3 weeks ago, Egypt closed its land border with Gaza, and that's where the Palestinians were getting a majority of their supplies, including foodstuffs. So this is going to hurt very seriously the Palestinian people.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. I mean, it's hard to overstate really the impact of this. And, I spent about 7 months in Gaza over a couple of year period filming my documentary that I released with Max Blumenthal called Killing Gaza, which, you can see if you go to killinggaza.com.
And it's fantastic, by the way. I encourage everybody to watch it.
Thank you. And so, we document what it's like to kind of live under this siege without the most basic, necessities for life. And so what does it mean to not have electricity? For us living in the U.S., it's kind of unthinkable. I mean, when if my power goes out at my house for a couple of minutes, it's kind of like panic mode, like, oh, my God, my world's been turned upside down. But, what does it mean? How does it affect people in a billion different ways to not have electricity. So that's, like I said, hospitals can't operate when you want to have hot water to take a shower, even just something as simple as that. You have to, you know, turn your heater on the night before. And usually when the power does come on for these 3 to 4 hours, it's in the middle of the night when people are asleep. So basically what's happened actually is Gaza has been forced to become a somewhat nocturnal population, staying up just to find those couple hours of electricity so people can charge their cell phones, talk to loved ones, you know, watch a TV show even, you know, imagine that, use your computer, have your router run and have internet, let alone, you know, the much more severe aspects of, you know, not being able to operate hospitals and, you know, things of that nature. So it's, I mean, it's just absolutely devastating and incredibly cruel. And really, I think, you know, the whole incendiary kite business is clearly just a pretext for continued collective punishment.
Dan Cohen is our guest. His movie made along with Max Blumenthal, Killing Gaza. People should go online, find out how to get it. And we'll ask Dan also how people can look at that movie, show that movie, use it in your community to educate people about what's going on to the people of Gaza. Dan Cohen, when you think about what's, you know, the big picture here, you have the Israeli military seizing the Freedom Flotilla going from Europe to Gaza with humanitarian supplies, including medical supplies, hijacking the boat, taking its crew prisoner. You have penalties being imposed on people all over the world as a consequence of Israeli lobbying pressure if you engage in boycott, divest, and sanctions, meaning the peaceful boycott of Israeli products. When you think about resistance, there was an armed resistance against Israeli occupation, and Gaza was seized in 1967, as was the West Bank, by virtue of a military operation from the Israeli Defense Forces. There was armed opposition. There's also civil opposition. There's peaceful opposition. There's opposition of all kinds. The Israeli government treats all forms of opposition essentially the same as a form of terrorism. And then in the Western media, at least in the U.S. corporate-owned media, we get the same impression. Not we, you know, people hear it loud and clear, but the larger population, if you're just getting your news from the corporate-owned media, everything that is done in opposition to this illegal occupation is a form of criminal conduct. That's the presentation. That's the narrative. So thus, the Palestinians actually, according to this logic, have no right to resist by any means the occupation of their homes, the occupation of their villages.
Exactly. I mean, for years, we've been seeing liberal pundits in the U.S. demand that Palestinians organize a peaceful march to, you know, demonstrate to Israelis that they just simply want peace. And that's exactly what they've been doing for the last 18, tomorrow will be, I believe, 18 Fridays in a row. Since March 30th, Palestinians have been marching in what they're calling the Great March of Return, where they simply just march towards the border, or it's actually not a border, I should say, the fence that cages them in away from Israel. And, you know, waving flags, dancing, you know, doing traditional, you know, Palestinian cultural dances like Dabka and these sorts of things, and protesting, you know, some of the, you know, especially the young men will throw rocks, but that's kind of to be expected. It's a form of protest. They certainly know that throwing rocks at heavily armed soldiers isn't going to actually, you know, is not like some kind of military maneuver that's going to overthrow the occupation. It's simply just a form of protest. And they have been met with bloody violence. Israel has now killed 151 Palestinians and injured several thousand, including several children. A couple of days ago, they just shot and killed a 16-year-old and an 11-year-old, shot them both in the back who were protesting. They've killed two journalists. They've shot health workers. So in the meantime, it's total silence from the pundit class in the U.S. who has demanded that they march peacefully, and that's what it has overwhelmingly been. And it just shows what a farce it is that the liberal class in this country, in the U.S., is completely on the side of Israel, no matter what, and should be discredited as any kind of you know, serious commentators on the issue. And they are perfectly comfortable with you know, constant apartheid and, you know, increasingly eliminationist rhetoric that, you know, I think is fair to say is genocidal. I mean, the defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, before he was brought in as defense minister, he was kind of considered a clown in Israeli politics. And he at one point said, every disloyal Arab should be beheaded with an axe. And so, you know, and then he was brought in and all this stuff is forgotten. All this fanaticism is forgotten. And it's just, oh, it's just Israel versus the Palestinians. And the Palestinians need to show that they want peace. And it's just, you know, it's the goalposts keep moving. And it ensures that there's never any kind of actual resolution to the so-called conflict.
You know, John, we live in an area, Washington, D.C., metropolitan area, a couple million people like Gaza. Just think if tomorrow a foreign power said, well, guess what? You're not going to have any more fuel. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have gasoline. You're not going to have air conditioning. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have light. You're not going to have anything because we don't like some policy of the U.S. government. I mean, the American people have to wake up, or maybe we have to help because the news is so biased against the Palestinians, to explain what this is. Genocidal, yes. It's a kind of slow motion genocide against the whole people.
It is indeed. We'll talk about it a lot more. We were joined from Washington by journalist and filmmaker Dan Cohen. You can watch his documentary Killing Gaza at killinggaza.com. Don't miss it. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Pope Francis announced this morning that the death penalty is inadmissible under any circumstances and that the Church will work toward its abolition around the world. The announcement marks an evolution of the Catholic Church's official view of the death penalty that began under Pope John Paul II in 1978. We're joined from New York by Gregory Joseph. He's communications director at the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, John, on this very historic and important day for all the abolitionists out there.
And that's exactly what I wanted to start off with. Explain to us just how important this announcement is.
Well, I think it's very important anytime someone with the leadership and stature of the Pope makes a statement that basically says that murdering people and killing people is cruel and beneath our collective humanity. The Pope obviously has millions and millions of followers and leads the Catholic Church, and people respect his opinion and follow his teachings. And now that the Catholic Church has decided to begin to teach the fact that the death penalty and capital punishment is wrong, moving forward to young children across the globe, this is a historic day.
Do you envision any legislation coming out of this announcement, either here in the United States or elsewhere around the world?
Well, you know, the European Union has been very progressive with regard to the death penalty. You're actually not allowed to be a member of the European Union if your country supports the death penalty. So our friends in Europe have been very progressive. Here in the United States, I mean, we're seeing very quick movements in terms of the death penalty being abolished or at least slowed down for various of reasons. Do I see actual legislation being advanced in some of the states? It's a possibility. There are bills that have been moved through various legislatures in some of the states that have addressed concerns about the death penalty, not to abolish it, but definitely make it a more of a rare practice and a rare sentence and make sure that it is fundamentally fair and correct. Now, we don't believe in fair and correct as a way to fix it. We believe in abolishment. But the fact that people are talking about and addressing some systemic problems about the death penalty is encouraging.
I recall the governor of Illinois relatively recently, and then in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the governor of New Mexico commuting all of the death sentences on death row as they were leaving office so that those death sentences became life without parole. I suppose that's a step in the right direction, but I wonder why they waited until the end of their terms instead of trying to push legislation through their respective legislatures. Did they not have public support or the support of the state houses and state senates in their states?
Well, I can't really speak to exactly what the politics were in both of those states, but obviously commuting sentences at the very end of your term is a very non-political way to get across a political message without coming across resistance. But we have seen that the death penalty in various states, there are people who have been categorically opposed to it, and they have been working hard, whether it's through legislation or through legal challenges, to make sure that the death penalty is not being handed down. We also see a lot of district attorneys now who are actually at the front lines of the death penalty, because they're the ones who actually call for the death penalty, not relying on a death penalty as a sentence option. So we're seeing that there are some people out there who are willing to take the stand like they have in Illinois and New Mexico. And for that matter, I mean, we've seen the abolishment of the death penalty in Maryland. We've seen the abolishment of the death penalty in New Jersey in the last 10 years. And we've also seen a lot of states actually slow down or actually put a moratorium on the death penalty so they can address some of the issues. So as the Chief Justice once said, the grinding machinery of the death penalty has not come to a halt, but it's definitely slowed down in encouraging ways for the movement.
And let's talk about those moratoria. There are a handful of states in the country, Texas, Virginia, that execute a lot of people. Most of the people who are executed in the United States, I think, are probably executed in those two states. What about moratoria in other states? Are these moratoria being put in place because of political or ideological opposition to the death penalty, or because of the debate over lethal injections and the drugs used in lethal injections being painful, for example?
Well, the pharmaceutical companies have especially been very vocal about their denial and their opposition to using their drugs to further the death penalty. And so supplies of these lethal drugs have been cut off from these states because they're using them in a way that pharmaceutical companies do not want their drugs to be used. And that has been the cause of a few moratoriums. We have a few states across the country now that are scrambling to create new death penalty protocols to make up for the lack in access to these drugs. So we're getting not just from legislative action, but corporate businesses and corporate interests saying that they don't want to be a part of the machinery of death, and it's been very encouraging. From a legislative and legal side, we do see challenges to lethal injection. Some of them are based on the fact that the protocols that these states have to adopt in the absence of these drugs represents a cruel and unusual punishment. It might sound just macabre to say, but, you know, if you're going to die, you have a right to know how you're going to die. And the fact that these states are sometimes putting it together with scotch tape and bubble wrap at the very last moment doesn't really seem to make any sense and adds to the cruel and unusual nature of the punishment. But we also see people raising their voice because they're seeing a fundamental unfairness with the death penalty in terms of its application. We're seeing people who are sentenced to death more so than other people are sentenced to death, and people of color are being sentenced to death at a higher rate than white people. And so people are saying that there's not a fundamental fairness. And then lastly, the advent of DNA. I mean, we are not 100% certain that we're executing people who are actually in or who could actually be innocent. And the advent of DNA have raised the spectrum of these cases now to people to say, mate, slow down. We might not have this 100% correct. And nobody wants to have an innocent person executed. So states are really kind of doing a little bit more due diligence to make sure that they actually have the right person who has been sentenced to these crimes.
We're speaking with Gregory Joseph. He joins us from New York. He's the communications director at the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Gregory, tell us what people can do to help the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. How can they get involved and help push this idea across all 50 states?
Well, I mean, it's just basic mobilization and grassroots organizing, just as you would do around any issue, whether it's immigration, whether it's criminal justice reform, whether it's taxes and the economy. You have to talk to your neighbors, and you have to talk to your friends, and go to your local churches, and go to your local community centers, and advocate for people to actually take a stand against the death penalty. I mean, we have a midterm election. Everyone has heard about it. It's not a surprise to people, and people are going to be running on their records, and they're going to be running on records on issues that matter to the people. If we raise the death penalty as an issue that legislators should be able to go to their legislators and say, this is something we need to work on. Repeal is something we need to work on. There's all these elections going on, and right now we're living in an unprecedented time of mobilization and grassroots organizing, and the death penalty should take their place right along these issues, because it's a fundamental way that we treat people, just the same way that we are upset about the immigration policies, because it is a poor way of treating people. The death penalty is exactly the same way in terms of treating people. So I would just tell people to speak up. We have the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty has affiliate chapters across the country in every state. The ACLU, Amnesty International, all work along the same lines of abolishing the death penalty. But it's out there making your voice heard on the issues that are important, and make sure that the people who are running for office, who are accountable to the people, are hearing your voice.
Tell me where you're most optimistic here in the United States. Are there any states that are making this policy change that we've seen in Maryland and New Jersey to abolish the death penalty? And I'm not talking about moratoria. I'm talking about actually enacting legislation to abolish it.
Well, you know, there's a lot of activity going on to the state, so I don't want to highlight one state or the other, but Ohio is very encouraging. Governor Kasich 2 weeks ago commuted a sentence of a death row inmate, and the two individuals running for governor in his replacement have also talked about the fact, not outright abolition, but they need to correct some of the inequities and systemic failures that their current protocols have. There's also been some encouraging movement in Washington state as well, with some legislation that has moved through various committees and one chamber of the legislature that could be enacted if we get a few more legislators in who are sympathetic to the idea of abolishing the death penalty. But death penalty, you know, like I said, this can all change with one election cycle. And the more people who are in or elected into office who support abolition or support moratoriums or for correcting some systemic failures, this can all change in a heartbeat. If you just look at how, you know, quickly, you know, legislation on the national level has changed with an election cycle. I mean, 1 minute we did not have universal health care, and 1 minute we did have universal health care, and it just was with the election of someone. We're talking about free college tuition now ever since Bernie Sanders ran on it, and now people in New York, for instance, have been elected based on that policy premise. So it's really, you know, we're at a very unprecedented time right now where we have a lot of people running for office. We have a lot of organizing around progressive issues and criminal justice issues. And, it, you know, this can turn into a positive momentum shift changer for the movement right after November.
I'm looking at a piece that was published at BBC.com this morning, the British Broadcasting Corporation. It says something at the very end that I think is very interesting, and it addresses specifically this issue of Catholicism and the change in the Catholic Church's view of the death penalty. It says in 1952, which is relatively recently, Pope Pius XII said that the death penalty was not a violation of the universal right to life. That began changing under John Paul II, and it culminated this morning with Pope Francis's edict that it is unacceptable and inadmissible in all cases. But where I find it the most interesting, it says, the death penalty is still legal in 53 countries around the world. That's frankly more than I thought had it still legal. In the United States, where 22% of the population are Catholic, execution is still legal in 31 states. 31 out of the 50 states still have the death penalty. It is also still legal in Cuba, Dominica, and Uganda, where about half the populations are Catholic. The only place in Europe where it's still legal is Belarus, which has a sizable Catholic minority. Burkina Faso, Madagascar, and Benin, where significant chunks of the population follow Catholicism, have all outlawed the death penalty in recent years. So it seems to me, and I'm going to put words in your mouth and give you the last word, it seems to me that the trend is in the right direction.
Oh, those are good words to put in my mouth, so I appreciate that, John. And you're right. I mean, look, what the Pope has said is going to have ramifications, not just in this country, but across the globe. And people of faith have united against the death penalty of all faiths. And so the fact that the Catholic Church is caught up with other faiths and people of faith, this is just going to reverberate through churches and communities across this country. I hope, and we all hope, that, you know, the Pope has spoken out against a lot of positive things and people have taken his word to heart and to gospel. And I think with this message that the Catholic Church now respects life across the board, whether it's pro-life, the sanctity of life, and in recognizing that the death penalty is beneath our collective humanity. You know, we affirm that, you know, the pledge to work with the people who want to abolish the death penalty worldwide, and we welcome the Catholic Church to this abolition movement.
It's a positive change. Well, that was the voice of Gregory Joseph. He's the communications director at the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and he joined us from New York. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration has imposed sanctions on the justice and interior ministers of Turkey in retaliation for the continued incarceration of American pastor Andrew Brunson. Brunson was arrested 2 years ago and charged with espionage for preaching. He has yet to go on trial. Turkish President Erdogan said the move will jeopardize longstanding U.S.-Turkish relations and that Ankara would consider retaliatory sanctions. We're joined from Zurich by Max Zerngast. He's an independent journalist and translator. Max, welcome to the show. Max, you just got to Zurich from Istanbul. Tell us what people are saying there.
This is by now a known tactic of the Erdogan regime. They are, I think we could call it that way, taking hostage foreign citizens on trumped-up charges. Mr. Brunson's accused of collaborating, among other organizations, with the PKK, with the Kurdistan Workers Party. I mean, there's absolutely, this doesn't make any sense at all. You know, things like that. They had this before with German journalists, human rights activists, and so on. In order to, you know, force other countries to do some things they want to do. On the other hand, of course, the United States, well, you know better than we do what kind of a country the United States is. It's the leading imperialist country still, and is constantly interfering in other countries' affairs whenever it can. So what happened now is that this is a gift for Erdogan, and I think it is also very positive for Trump as well, actually. Both sides will profit from this crisis, so to say. On the Turkish side, basically the whole opposition, including some left-wing organizations, speak the same language as Erdogan, you know, against U.S. imperialism, against U.S. interference and all that. So there's a very broad consensus on that. So it's very positive for Erdogan, actually.
Well, tell us your opinion on how this is going to play out. And it's not just Andrew Brunson. There are two Greek border guards who accidentally strayed over the border and have been held for several months now. Interestingly enough, none of these people ever get a trial. They're just held like hostages. What is it that Erdogan wants in exchange for releasing these people?
It depends. We also had the same story with a German, Turkish-born journalist, but German citizen, Deniz Yücel, who was released only a few months ago after being held for about a year or even more than a year without any trial, without any, well, let alone a trial, any form of accusation beyond some rumblings by officials. So there's no official accusation by a Turkish court or any prosecutor against these people, mostly. Sometimes there's some stuff, but mostly there is nothing at all, which is not so uncommon. You know, according to the current state of affairs in Turkey, which is actually now not officially a state of emergency anymore, but in fact, it is a state of emergency. People are held for a long time without ever facing charges, without ever going on trial. So that is a practice not only against foreign citizens, but also against Turkish citizens. What is it that he wants? I mean, that is not an easy question to answer. It depends. In the case of Greece, it's something else. In the case of Germany, it's something else. In the case of the United States, it's something else. There are some tensions for years now between the United States and Turkey about the coup attempt, about other incidents. It's only the moments where these tensions surface, become visible. But there's some larger issues at stake. I mean, in the most general sense, what is at stake, I think, is that the hegemony of the United States in the world system is declining. The trade wars, the rise of Russia and China, we all see that anyway. And within, you know, these shifting relations of power, countries like Turkey, they get their share of the cake, so to say. They think they can do something regionally, at least. In the case of Turkey, it is especially in regard to Syria. But it can get something from the United States they wouldn't otherwise get. You know, if there's a strong imperialist power, a strong leading power in place, that would not be possible, maybe. But now, the United States struggling on many fronts to, you know, hold its ground. Countries like Turkey or other countries of the same or similar size and strength try to do something regionally. And I think Syria is still the heart of the matter here.
Okay, let's come back to that in a moment. I want to ask you something that you said. Erdogan wins in this situation and Trump also wins. Win-win for both of them. What does Trump win?
He wins in so far as his own supporters, or at least some parts of the base, especially right-wing, xenophobic, Islamophobic supporters of Trump, will be pleased because he is playing a strong man against a predominantly Muslim country. I mean, that is the most visible thing that I can see. If there's other things, yeah, maybe we'll have to see. Maybe he's forcing something now or the United States are forcing something with those sanctions, you know, putting Turkey in a difficult place, and then they can get something from Turkey over Syria or similar issues. We don't know that yet. So this is making moves within a balance of power. It's clear that the stronger power here is the United States, but the United States is not only dealing with Turkey, it's dealing with the whole world in a way.
Max Zerngast is our guest. He's an independent journalist and translator. We're talking to him from Zurich. He just arrived back from Istanbul. And we're talking about the fact that the U.S. government, the Trump administration, has imposed or is imposing new sanctions on Turkey after Turkey failed to release an American pastor, a Christian pastor who's in prison there. Max, I want to go back to the geostrategic pose that Erdogan has adopted. You said the issue for him may be Syria. Of course, in the case of Syria, the main goal of the Turks seems to be to prevent any sort of Kurdish autonomous or semi-autonomous region in the northern or northeastern, northwestern part of the country. Turkish troops have been in northern Syria. That's a smaller sort of goal than what Erdogan probably had in mind in 2011 when he had sort of neo-Ottoman Empire fantasies about the expansion of Turkey into what used to be the Ottoman Empire, which included, of course, Syria. What's the goal? What's the final goal for Erdogan in Syria?
The final goal by now cannot be any big thing anymore, right? Because he lost a lot of ground. The Turkish state lost a lot of ground and its strategy failed. In 2011, as you said, it was actually with the so-called Arab Spring. Turkey thought its moment had arrived in the Middle East to emerge as one of the hegemonic powers, as the regional hegemonic power in the Middle East, especially via their partners, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and other countries, and also similar groups in Syria. By now, of course, that failed, and we all see that very clearly that it failed. But there are two things that are important here. The one is obviously, as you already mentioned, the Kurdish threat, which is a threat in the Turkish eyes. Otherwise, well, that's probably not the right description. But for Turkey, it's a threat, and they want to prevent Kurdish expansion or any form of Kurdish state or statelet on its borders. So that be Syria, Iraq, or wherever. But it's most imminent, of course, in Syria. The other thing is that after the Syrian army has taken over the region of the city of Dera in the south of Syria, close to the Jordanian border, on the Jordanian border, close to Israel, the last remaining stronghold of opposition, that is Islamic fighters, in this case, especially the Al-Nusra Front, former Al-Qaeda, is Idlib. Idlib, the Idlib region on the Turkish border. So in Idlib, there's actually Turkish forces on the ground. So they are not only in Afrin, not only in Elbab, where there was a direct intervention of the Turkish army, they also stationed a lot of soldiers and military materials, tanks, weapons, and all that in Idlib. So it is very clear that within a few months at latest, the Syrian army will start its operation on Idlib to take back the last stronghold of the opposition, save the Kurdish opposition, of course. And what we have seen in recent weeks is that the Syrian war is coming to an end. And most actors in this war, and they are very different actors, local, national, international, most actors seem to have agreed that the end is near. There have been meetings between Kurdish representatives and representatives of the Assad government a week or two ago, which is a clear indication that after Idlib will fall, and almost certain that it will fall eventually, question is now only that the cost of that, the human cost, the material cost. After Idlib will fall, Kurdish-dominated forces and the Assad regime will have to arrive at some treaty or some form of agreement over the future of Syria. And Russia and the United States are in this as well as dominant players. And that somehow leaves Turkey outside of that. And Turkey wants to be a player in Syria. But especially if Idlib falls, then they won't have a lot to say on the ground anymore.
The Turkish behavior in Syria and elsewhere around the region is something that certainly bears watching because it's causing a lot of problems in the area. We have to end it there. We were joined from Zurich by Max Zirngast. He's an independent journalist and a translator. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.